This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Moore. I want to say something to you today, and I want you to hear me right and understand. In my opinion, and this comes from both professional and personal experience, I wager that there is no darker place, particularly for a parent, to be in than when it comes to the loss of a child. You're looking for rock bottom, you're here. It seems like nothing else in the world matters. It's as if a part of you has died as well, and it has. I want to revisit a case today that we've talked about previously on Body Bags. And the reason I want to talk about this today is that there have been developments. There have been developments in the case involving a tiny little life, a life that died in the midst of childbirth, and the horror that followed that event. What I'm talking about is the early premature death of a little one named Trevion Isaiah Taylor Jr., otherwise known as Baby Isaiah. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Dave Mack, when we initially covered Baby Isaiah's death, I remember following that episode, I felt as though I needed to go take a shower.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to scrub my brain because I couldn't believe some of the things that we were hearing that were coming out of, well, let's face it, the south side of Atlanta, down in Clayton County, where this baby had died at Southern Regional Hospital. That story in and of itself is horrific. But what happened afterwards in trying to understand what brought about this little angel's death, it's like you see something that is bad and then you think it can't get any worse. And then all of a sudden it does.
Yeah, it got worse. You know, Joe, when we did this first episode about Baby Isaiah dying at birth, and we will recover this again for those who haven't heard the story yet, but you know, I didn't really go into a personal side of this that much. And when my daughter Hannah was born, she was stuck. She was not getting over a part. Now, LaDonna had a child previously by C-section, and she wanted to have Hannah a vaginal delivery. And everything was fine. But she was getting stuck. She was not getting over a hump in there that was keeping her from, and the doctor was not operating as quickly as the nurse who was standing there with me thought he should be. But she's a nurse. I'm the dad. This is my wife, and you're the doctor. I didn't like what he was doing either, but the bottom line is I realized then how out of control I was. I cannot do anything to help.
Yeah.
And thankfully this nurse, when the doctor turned, she said, "Dave, grab her head and push it up into her belly as hard as you can." And that's how we got Hannah out. He had brought up forceps and actually did cut her, which I know there's a necessity to them, but please, God love you, don't do that.
Yeah.
But because it does leave damage that stays for a lifetime and it can be really bad.
Yeah.
We didn't experience that part, but
yeah, I had a friend of mine that, during his birth, he wound up having his eye was compromised in birth as a result of the manipulation that went on.
Right.
And his eye was always, some people might call it a lazy eye,
but yeah, it was drooping a little.
It was drooping, but there was still visible, structurally, you could tell that there was something that was off. And a lot of it has to do with how malleable the skull is, I think. But that malleability can sometimes lead to, I think maybe some practitioners thinking that the body is more resilient sometimes than it actually is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the case of Isaiah.
We heard about how that, what happened though, Joe. In that case, the nurses were talking about the pressure that came to bear and the suction that this doctor used. And we probably need to go over that a little bit, because whereas I was present when things were happening with LaDonna and Hannah, and I realized then, again, how difficult this is. We take it for granted. We take so many things in our life today for granted. Childbirth cannot be taken for granted. It's a moment where the new life, the life of your partner, everybody is at risk. There's a lot of risk going on at childbirth. And I'm so thankful that we have in this country such a great record for having children. But you know what? This story of baby Isaiah and the cover-up that took place after it tells you that things are not what they seem sometimes. And you better trust, you better study up before you go to have a baby. Know what a normal delivery time is. Know how long a woman should be in labor before you push for something else. Because apparently this doctor didn't have a clue. It boggles my mind, Joe.
Yeah, it does mine as well. And that you have to look at their track record. That's why, you know, the thing about it is, I think in America, we're so prone to, well, this person has MD after their name and they have these board certifications. Obviously they know what they're doing and they wouldn't put, you know, my unborn child soon to be born at risk and wouldn't put, and I'm speaking as a husband now, wouldn't put my wife's life at risk because they've been trained to do these sorts of things. And when, you know, we begin to discuss this and talk about the horror that was involved and what was, and I'll say it right here, what was perpetrated upon this very young couple, Dave, where they didn't know any better. I mean, you remember when you were a young parent. I remember when, you know, I didn't have my first child until I was a little bit older. You know, it's not like I was a 19-year-old kid, but still you lean into the idea that they're so well trained and that they're so highly educated and that they're going to help you. You can't see this kind of catastrophe happening, particularly to you, you know, and the ones that you love, and then insult to injury, drag everybody into this idea that we're going to present these circumstances as if it's just the child died. The child died. There was nothing we could do.
And nothing we did to cause it.
And nothing. Yeah, we cannot, you know, we're not responsible for this. But Dave, I got to tell you, man, the physical evidence here bears out something a bit different now, doesn't it?
Oh, buddy. Well, you know, it started July 9th. Of 2023, two years, coming up on the two-year anniversary.
Wow.
This baby would be a little toddler right now.
Yep.
And Trevion and Isaiah Taylor Sr. and Jessica Ross, expecting the child, they go through everything. She goes through the prenatal care. They do everything they're supposed to do. She goes into labor July 9th. And during the vaginal birth, the baby boy's shoulders got stuck.
Yeah.
Now, you know a lot more about biology and how the body works than I do. But a shoulder getting stuck during birth doesn't seem like it would be something unheard of, something that can't be overcome.
It's not.
In this day and age that you'd know something's obviously not right here.
Yeah. And so most of the time in these deliveries, there are multiple ways that you can kind of spur things on. I think one of the things that kind of comes to mind first. Then these are not necessarily applicable in every mm-hmm. one of the circumstances, but some things we just kind of naturally think about is like, an episiotomy, if you've ever heard that term. If you think of the vaginal opening as a clock face, at the 6 o'clock position, there will be an incision made, and that's to accommodate the size of the child in order to facilitate, because there's this critical point, I think, that when practitioners get to where they have to make a decision, if we're going to do a C-section, we need to do it now before it gets to this point. And that's the rub here, but there's suction that's available. There's various rotations of the child's body that can take place. That's one of the things that doctors will do, and the nurses, the midwives, that go in and they can turn the baby in order to facilitate this. And it takes, you have to have a great scientific mind to be an effective practitioner, but it takes a bit of finesse too that comes along with just experience and these sorts of things. And every person is different in how they're going to respond, because not everybody's body is the same, man.
I'm so glad you said that, Joe, because as I was sitting here thinking about this, of my children had a little bit of problem with Andrew, but no problems with Tyler. Haley was a C-section, but then Hannah, that was the only problem I had encountered with the child being born. And I'm still remembering that moment. And that's why this really has hit home for me. It really has, because I made some decisions for my wife that I had to make that I wasn't prepared to make, just in case. But I also look at this now and realize that this child, they tried to use traction to pull this baby out. His shoulders are stuck. He's not coming out. And this woman, this poor woman, is in labor for hours, Joe, for hours and hours. And the baby gets stuck at 8:40 p.m. They know the time the baby gets stuck, 8:40 p.m. That's when the trauma begins. They, meaning the nurses and everything, they're like, we need to do an emergency C-section. Doctor didn't do it. Kept pulling. Kept using suction. Was using traction, rather. What is traction on the head of a baby?
Well, with this methodology that you're referring to, they can brace the head in a particular way so that they can apply leverage in the vaginal opening and literally pull. I think that a lot of people think, automatically when you think about traction, okay, first thing you think about is when you're treating an adult that has like a neck injury.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, and you set up in traction in order to elongate the spine. And that's generally from a manipulative standpoint. And I mean that in the sense of manipulation of the spine and the musculature, the structure and everything. Matter of fact, one of the medical examiners I used to work with, he's passed on now. He suffered from Guillain-Barré syndrome. And he had all kinds of muscle issues and those sorts of things. And he would put himself in traction in his office every day. And his doctor had urged him to do this, and he would counterweight it with bags of water. And I'll never forget this contraption he had set up on his sofa, and it would literally elongate or pull his head. And I never could understand the rash, and I didn't have deep conversations with this man.
Right.
He was very, very formal person. I just saw it in there, and I asked him one time, what is that? And he says, that's traction for my Guillain-Barré. And I'm thinking, that's interesting. I didn't know you needed traction for Guillain-Barré, but whatever. But you're talking about when you apply this kind of force to a baby that's not even born yet. Okay. We always think about how resilient little kids are. They can take certain types of force and trauma that we as adults can't, but that tissue is so very fragile, Dave. And all it takes is this kind of force being exerted over a protracted period of time, which is what happened. And Dave, I got to tell you, for our listeners that don't know, she applied so much force for such a long period of time. That she actually wound up decapitating this child. Do you remember, Dave? I know I do vividly, when your newborn is swaddled for the first time. And they hand that child to you. And first off, you have this feeling that you're insufficient to the task.
Oh yeah.
Even though people have been doing this for thousands and thousands of years, you think you're the one person in all of human history that's not going to be able to do this. And it's a real fear. It's a real fear, particularly, I think, for men in particular, because we can be really clumsy and sometimes.
I'm so afraid I was going to drop Andrew. That was my biggest fear.
I kept thinking
so
football
big.
Or
he was
eggs.
So big. He was almost 10 pounds and he was huge. And it was like, I kept thinking, if I drop him, what happens?
Yeah. You know, exactly.
I couldn't get that out of my head. And for the longest time.
Terrifying. And it's terrifying just putting him in the car and bring him home. It was for me, you know, but. The joy that is kind of, it's one of those moments. It's a spiritual moment, I would say. My wife always says that when her children have been born, she knows that God was present in the room. That's what she's always said. And when that child is handed over to you and you embrace that child, I get chills just speaking about it right now, that precious moment. And Dave, it's my understanding, and I might be misremembering, but it is true that they were not allowed to hold this baby immediately.
No.
And that's where this thing kind of really goes off the rails.
Well, you're right. It goes off the wheels fairly early on, but here's the deception. And here's the, okay. She's in labor for a number of hours. The shoulders are stuck and they say, okay, we're going to have to do an emergency C-section. So hours after labor begins, they wheel her upstairs to do this emergency C-section. As Joe told you just a minute ago, the baby was decapitated. They actually pulled the baby's trunk or the body without the head by C-section.
Yep.
And she had to give birth to the baby's head.
Yeah.
Now, the parents don't know what's going on.
No.
They don't have a clue because
these are kids.
Yeah, they're young.
In my mind.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and they are, but you know what? They don't know what to expect. Look, the doctor's there. They're doing a C-section. You don't know what all's going on. Just, you know, you know what you're told. And so as they're doing these things and they get they then take the baby. The parents don't know the baby is decapitated. Now, they are told the baby didn't live. And the nurses or the staff, I'm going to say staff. I don't want to impugn anybody. I don't know who did this.
Right.
I don't know. But I know that this couple wanted to hold their baby.
Right.
Dead or not, we want to hold our baby. That's our baby. We've already got a name for this baby. It's Trevion Isaiah. You know, this is my son. And so the staff then wrapped this baby's body and head in such a way that they placed the head on top of the body and wrapped it like you would swaddle a baby, but wrapped it tighter around the head so they could pass it off as a natural death at birth, that there was nothing wrong, just the baby died at birth.
Yeah.
Now, I go back to my fear of holding, you know, my son Andrew when he was born. And I'm thinking they were probably the same way, even though they know the baby is dead. They're thinking the baby's stillborn, you know, they're thinking something along those lines has transpired. They're grieving. They're exhausted. They're panicked. They're all the horrible things that you must go through at that moment. I cannot imagine. And they're handed this baby as if there's no more damage to look at. They were lied to. They were cheated and lied to by everybody involved. How do you hold a baby's head onto I don't know how you can do
that. How do you, you know, how do you fix the body to the point where you feel comfortable enough as a clinician? And clinician is a very broad term, can mean anybody who had a hand in this. You feel comfortable enough to hand the decapitated body of an infant, but yet the head has been placed and secured, quote unquote, in a manner in which you feel secure enough that the head, I hate to say this, is not going to roll off and wind up in the floor or wind up in mom's lap. Because I got to tell you, you know, when my child was born, my children have been born, I don't go to their toes to kiss their toes. I'm kissing all over that forehead. When my son Isaac died, I was holding him when he passed.
Oh my God.
And I kissed that baby all over his face. You know, and it's one of those things, I'm telling you, it's one of those things as a parent that you, it's almost like it's confirmatory. To me it is, all right? Being the father of a child that passed away, you, I think that it's just that touch you want to confirm that a child has passed on, you know, and just the opposite. I mean, when a child is alive, you want to feel that warmth that transfers from their body to your lips as you're touching your lips to them. But Dave, if it, a kind of a hero appears in all of this, because if it had not been for the funeral home, in this case, my friend, the family would have been none the wiser. Can you imagine being a funeral director? You know, after the family has called you and said, look, we want to honor our child, have a service for the child. And yes, and let me tell you how this works in case folks are not aware. When someone passes away at a hospital, it could be a baby or an adult, they will fill out an entire death packet at the hospital. And when it's generally a social worker comes and talks to the family, they'll say, what funeral home do you want to handle this? And the social worker many times will reach out, you know, to the funeral home. Of course, family's reaching out at the same time too. And then they will arrange for the body to be picked up. Here's something that folks don't know. When babies die, they pass away in hospital. Did you know that we have a little, funeral homes in particular have these, they have these little oaken boxes. I guess they're probably about 3 feet. No, probably not that, about 2 feet by a foot, and they're hinged and they have a handle right in the center of it. And it looks like a miniature casket almost. And what they will do is they'll walk in to the morgue and they'll open the top of this box, and they place the baby in the box. They cover the baby in a sheet, and they transport the baby. And no one really knows what they have in the box. Okay. It's not like they walk in with a stretcher. They'll just walk right back out, get in the funeral home vehicle, and off they go to the funeral home to prep the body. First time I ever saw one of those things, it was, you know, and I've seen a lot of ghastly things. It kind of sent it like a night gallery, you know, Rod Serling night gallery kind of shiver up my spine, because it's got this kind of creepy old feel to it when you see these boxes. And they used to always have these. But when the funeral home came to pick up this child's body, I can only imagine that the people in the hospital that were thinking about this, they were thinking, how in the world are we going to explain this? Because now that body's out of our control. That body's out of our control. And you know what? That's no different, Dave, than these cases that we have talked, and we've had this discussion, brother, where we've talked about how perpetrators that kill individuals, sometimes they will bury them at their own home. They'll retain the body so that they always can guarantee that they have total and complete control over the body. And for me, that pops in my mind with this, where they're thinking, oh my Lord, you know, once that threshold is crossed, we no longer have control over these remains.
That's exactly what happened. You know, it was kind of interesting here, because I've approached this, having experienced something now that I'm much more familiar with the process of death at a hospital. And, I look at this young couple. They expected to go into the hospital as two and come out with a family of three.
Yep.
And beginning their life together. And now they're faced with all of these very fast decisions that have to be made.
Yes.
Because, and they're pushed on it. They want answers. They want to know what happened. They're told by the hospital that they don't have a right to a free autopsy. You know, they want to know what happened. You know, why did my baby die? Why is my son not going home with me? And the hospital is like, no, you don't have a right to know. I mean, yeah, you can pay for it. If you want to pay to have it done, you have done, but it just baby died. Babies die during birth. It happens. Sorry. And so they're kind of bum rushed out of the place. Now, as this baby was taken to the nursing, funeral home. And I'm so glad you mentioned the heroic nature of this, because had it not been for the funeral home, nobody would have known. No. The cover up would have been easy. And I'm going to be honest with you. I wonder how many times things are done, you know, with a phone call and a couple $1,000 to somebody. Think about it. They could have done a number of things that we would have never known about this, but, they were told they had to pay for their own autopsy. And then after they found out from the nursing home that what had actually happened, you know, that there was a decapitation. And that's where I was wondering from your standpoint, from the, what happens when, look, I get that a baby dies naturally, they're a stillbirth, something like that. As horrible as that would be, that would have to be seen as different than a baby that is decapitated, right?
Yeah, it would. It would. And I got to tell you, with a, this is the interesting thing with, and this would be, and the way clinicians will frame this, and it's always made my teeth hurt every time I hear this term. They will use the term medical misadventure, and they throw that term around a lot. Well, it was a medical misadventure. Oh, well, you know, that's just the way things are.
Medical misadventure.
And I've worked cases, Dave, with quote unquote medical misadventure, where there was, where there was such shoddy work that was done that it would equate to, for a civilian in the civilian world outside of, and when I say civilian, I mean, I'm not talking about military. I'm talking about an average person outside of the clinical environment. You'd be charged with manslaughter at a baseline.
Right.
Okay. But yet they'll use that term medical misadventure many times. And I can tell you that's probably how, you know, that's what they're thinking perhaps in this particular case. And yeah, they had to, and well, let me educate you about one more thing. I feel like I'm preaching right now.
There are so many questions I have about this.
Well, listen, if a child dies, there are so many, first off, you want to know why did they die? Because if parents, which we know these parents had gone through all of their prenatal meetings, okay. They've been being followed, all these sorts of things, and the day's arriving, you know, they're all excited. For all I know, they went through Lamaze classes together. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But you have to be able to give a scientific reason why this child died. I think in most cases, even with stillbirths, that as part and parcel of the service that the hospital provides for, you know, a birth, if the child dies, it's pretty standard for them to do a hospital autopsy.
Okay.
You know, it truly is. And this idea that no, you're not. But back to the medical misadventure, Dave, this is actually a case that's reportable to the coroner.
Right. That's what I was thinking. It has to be, right?
Yeah, it is. And most of the time, stillbirths were reportable to the coroner or the medical examiner. Most of them are. I mean, I can't tell you how many stillbirth cases I've taken report of over the phone. Now, I wouldn't go to the hospital to examine a stillborn child, but it would still be reportable to us. We'd write a report up, okay? And sometimes the baby would have a name. Sometimes the baby would not have a name. It's a weird kind of thing that happens. And when you think about this ain't a stillbirth. This is not how you would define a stillbirth. Okay. Now if you've ever been in a labor and delivery suite, you know that, you know, there's monitors everywhere. You can monitor the baby's heartbeat, all that sort of stuff. And this is, I think what's the big mystery right now is to know if they had that fetal heart monitor going at that point in time. And this will be a question that will come up. At what point in time did that child arrest? Because this is not a stillbirth. This is not some kind of genetic thing that's going on where you know the child is not going to be viable and they die maybe in utero, which happens many times, and the mother has to deliver. Those are very sad. That is a classic stillbirth. This ain't no stillbirth, brother.
Right.
You're talking about a baby who's had his head removed during delivery. This is a traumatic death. Years ago, when I was working down in New Orleans, I was working both as a PATH assistant and as a coroner investigator. And I was working with this one physician, and he was rather in circles of forensic pathology. He was nationally well known. And I never could understand why he was working at our office. It's not that our office was a bad place. It's the level of renown that this individual had experience prior to arrival at our office was pretty significant. They had been a deputy chief medical examiner in a major U.S. city at one point in time, but yet they landed at our office. So you always have questions about that sort of thing. As it turned out, this individual had made a stop in between their deputy chief medical examiner position and our position in New Orleans. They had stopped off at another office. And while at that office, this forensic pathologist was tasked with trying to understand, could a baby sustain a fracture at a certain age when falling from a certain height? The forensic pathologist took it upon themselves to begin to conduct experiments. And as a result of those experiments, a baby or babies were dropped from a variety of heights. And it just so happened that this was witnessed by a staff member who reported them. When I found that out, that this individual had been involved in the so-called experiments, I couldn't believe that I was standing at the same table with this individual doing postmortem examinations with him, because they did wind up getting sued. They did wind up being found liable. And the university that they were associated with was sued as well. You know, it had only been, I guess at that time, that was in the 80s. It had only been, I don't know, probably at that time, less than 40 years earlier, when a group of people were doing experiments on another group of people. It's something that is so incredibly abhorrent. And it runs contrary to every single ideal that we hold up in the medical legal community. And Dave, I got to tell you, brother, if you thought the story of the decapitation when it comes to basic baby Isaiah is bad, this is what we meant. It went from bad to worse, and now we have new news that has burst on the horizon relative to all of this.
As you know, they did file lawsuits. You know, in this day and age, you're not going to get by without somebody standing in the gap and saying something is wrong here, and we're going to help you take care of this, and that's what they did. Thankfully, somebody did to help parents provide to, well, they sued just about everybody involved. But one thing they did, Joe, they got their own autopsy done. Remember how I told you the hospital said they weren't entitled to a free autopsy? That was the hospital's way of bullying them. Get them out of the hospital. Was. Get them out of here.
I concur with your assessment, brother.
But they got an autopsy. They found it. And you, to be clear, I asked you about this earlier during the previous show, because I didn't know you could pay for an autopsy. Like, I mean, I didn't really think about it. Because I would just assume that if a body needs an autopsy, it gets done. Not that you actually have to fight to have an autopsy done on your child. And that's what they did. They paid to have it done. They found a doctor that would do it. Now, that was the good news. The bad news is, well, again, remember that this family did not hear from the doctor, the nurses, or anybody at the hospital what had happened to their baby. They didn't find that out. They found it out from the nursing home. The funeral home. So, realizing they were lied to, they went and hired Dr. Jackson Gates to perform an autopsy. Dr. Jackson Gates does an autopsy. And then, in a violation of every thing I can imagine, I cannot think of one redeeming thing to say about what he did with a videotape of the autopsy.
For years, this is okay. Just so that we're clear on this, for years, I've had people that would come to me and they would beg to be able to attend an autopsy. Just people that are curious. I've got, tons of medical students, nursing students, and of course cops, because autopsies are not something that you normally get access to. First off, you have no way of vetting the person that's going to come through the door. You don't know who's going to show or what their true reason is. And nowadays in particular, you never know what the reason is. You know, I mean, you can't do anything in public without somebody having a camera.
Right.
And they're videotaped. You could just be having a regular everyday discussion with somebody and something that you say can be taken out of context. Mm-hmm. Well, I got to tell you, it might wind up on social media. And Dave, again, we have an example of somebody, a pathologist, who felt like that it was a good idea to do the postmortem examination on this precious child. And then display the body in an Instagram reel. An Instagram reel, Dave.
Pictures and video. Up.
Yeah, pictures and video of this child's macerated body. And display it. So it's like,
and by the way, without the permission of the parents. Now, I could see if, and I can't imagine a parent doing this, but let's just say for the sake of argument that Dr. Gates went to them and said, look, there's some educational value.
Yeah.
I would like to share some of this autopsy with whoever, other professionals, whatever. Yeah. There might be some value in that. I don't know what it would be, but Dr. Jackson Gates doesn't bother to ask them permission to do anything. He posts them on Instagram for all the world to see. And that's how they found out about it. It wasn't like they called for permission, Joe. Somebody saw it and said, hey, what is this?
Well, you ought to have the good sense to understand, first off, that it doesn't. You don't have to be a board certified forensic pathologist to appreciate this. This is going to wind up in a lawsuit. And I'm not talking about the Instagram thing, which obviously it does. However, the death of this baby at this hospital is going to wind up in litigation. In what universe have you decided that this is a good idea, that I should take imagery of this baby and display it for the entire world? Particularly, that's bad enough, but particularly understanding the fact that this is going to go to court. Okay. It's going to go to court. I can, you know, dollars to donuts, I bet you that it's going to go to court, which it's going to, and you're going to, you've, so not only are you compromising the, not only are these poor parents being subjected to this emotionally, what happened to their baby, what they eventually found out with the decapitation during birth. And not only are you humiliating them further, because this is the ultimate in humiliation by displaying the desecrated remains of their baby, now you're putting them at risk for what's going to happen in the courts later on, you know, by displaying this images, you know, because any defense attorney worth their weight is going to be questioning this imagery that's put up with, and they'll ask questions. They'll say, well, you know, our defendant here was just trying to do their job at the hospital as an OBGYN. Now you've hired this person that's going to display this for the whole world. It's a mockery, you know, and now our client can't be treated fairly by the courts. You see how this works? And so your inability to be able to control your actions relative to social media and what's going to happen, you know, I hope against hope that there is some, you can never replace a child, period. And as you, as we always say on the show, there's no such thing as closure. But I hope that the reward that is going to drop into the lap of this family, and I'm not talking about just monetarily, but receiving some kind of satisfaction from the courts, is going to go at least some small way in trying to heal them in some level, so that maybe they'll be brave enough to have another child at some point in time. But I got to tell you, brother, if this was me, it would put me so off of wanting to bring new life into this world by this experience.
Yeah.
I would really question my reality, man.
They did sue everybody involved, including Dr. Gates. Now, the reason we're doing the show update today is because the trial, the jury has made an announcement about the lawsuit about what Dr. Gates did. He's the one that did the autopsy and put the stuff on social media. I want to read you the jury's ruling.
Please.
We, the jury, find that for intentional infliction of emotional distress, invasion of privacy through intrusion into private affairs and fraud, defendant Jackson L. Gates, MD, and Gates Rapid Diagnostic Laboratory of Atlanta, doing business as Medical Diagnostic Choices, will pay $2 million in compensatory damages to Jessica Ross and Trevion Isaiah Taylor Sr. That was the jury's ruling. The jury also awarded an additional $250,000 in punitive damages. That's the maximum amount allowed. So $2.25 million that will be paid, hopefully, without argument by the insurance company that Dr. Gates has. I'm sure he has one. They start with that. Now, I want to be clear on this because this is not over. This is just Dr. Gates putting the video, which that's his. You know what, Joe? I cannot imagine. You can get past a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, you can look at it and go, even if I believe they were wrong and what happened was a bad outcome and they deserved to. You can get past that by saying they didn't intentionally kill my child. That wasn't their game plan. They weren't trying to kill this baby. The baby died by their actions, but that wasn't their intent. You could get by that at some point, maybe. But you can never get past the fact that an adult doctor that you're paying to give you the truth about what happened to your child violated your trust, emotional damage of putting your baby up for all the world to see, something so private, something so painful. They'll never get over that. No, there is no closure.
And you know what they say? The internet,
it's forever.
It lives forever. It lives forever. So whoever was out there that happened to see this before it was taken down, they've got video captures of this now, Dave.
Oh yeah.
I guarantee you, as sure as the sun is going to rise in the east tomorrow morning, I guarantee you that those images are floating around out there. What, you know, who does the family see about that? Who do they see about it? Please tell me. And I'm you know, I don't mean you to give me an answer for that, but who do you go and complain to about that? There is nobody you can complain to about that. This is a, you know, I would like to call this a series of unfortunate instances in their life. But Dave, some of this stuff, all the way from the birth to the postmortem circumstances, there is, and certainly with the delivery, I don't think that there's specific intent there, but there are decisions that could have been made that would have had a better outcome than what we're seeing right now. Because I got to tell you, Dave, there is not enough money in this old world to heal the broken hearts of these parents. May you rest in peace. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.